Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine and Lynn are pleased to welcome Dr. Rick Edelson. Dr. Edelson is Aaron and Marguerite Lerner Professor of Dermatology and Chair and Professor of the Department of Dermatology at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start the discussion tonight, since we're talking about immunotherapy. Let's start off by defining immunotherapy for the audience.
So immunotherapy is really one of those relatively few apt terms. It actually involves manipulation of the immune system to the benefit of the patients. It can be in cancer. It can be an important tool in the defense against cancer, even in the prevention against cancer. But it can also be a valuable tool when the immune system is an enemy in autoimmunity.
So your interest in immunotherapy dates way, way back. And the first disease that you really addressed with immunotherapy was a disease called cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Could you take us back, Rick, to how this all got started?
Well, thank you for saying that it goes way, way back, but it does. And it goes back to actually the time when very early in my career, I was at the National Cancer Institute. In the year that human T cells, the cells that are at the actual center of immune responses, were first identified. So it first became possible, all the way back, as you say, in 1972, to apply the new principles of immune cell recognition and demonstrate that the first malignancy of white blood cells shown to be a malignancy of T cells was cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, which was named cutaneous because it first involves the skin, and second, because the cells that are malignant are T-cells.
It really is interesting when you think about it, Rick, that we really didn't understand much about immunology until the 1970s when the T-cell was identified, and that so much has happened since that time.
Right. I mean, if you take cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, here was a disease which was a malignancy, starting, of course, as all malignancies do, from a normal counterpart cell. So a single normal T cell, which has a propensity to circulate through from the blood to the skin and back, becomes malignant, and many, many copies of that cell wind up amplifying the localization patterns of the cell. So the cell that typically normally helps defend against infections in the skin, for example, when it becomes malignant, shows up as tumors in the skin.
Rick, tell us and our listeners a little bit about the thought process you had in the development of photopheresis and what photopheresis is and what was happening during this exciting time.
So photopheresis was introduced by our group when I was still at Columbia University School of Medicine in 1982 and first became FDA approved as a therapy for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma in 1988. So what was happening in 1982, and I'm happy to say we were on our toes because it certainly wasn't discovered on purpose. I'd actually make the point that relatively few really important therapies are discovered on purpose. But the idea behind photopheresis at the beginning was not as an immunotherapy, but as what we thought was neat at the time, maybe trivial in retrospect, a chemotherapeutic drug that could be turned on by a light switch and only have its activity exactly where the light and the drug came together. So the goal was to be palliative or to not be curative, but to help a patient decrease severe symptomatology in the absence of systemic side effects. The the very first patients with a leukemic form of the disease, which is really devastating, had not responded to conventional chemotherapy and had total skin infiltrated. Your listeners can imagine what that would be like of these malignant cells. As well as the malignant cells in the blood, we treated only 2% of the patient's malignant cells by passing the blood through an apparatus to see if it was safe. And the goal was, if we could show that those cells could be safely returned and then removed by the filtration cell in the body, liver, spleen, lymph nodes, then we would then go ahead and treat the patient more frequently and simply try to decrease the number of cells by removing them faster than they were being made. The astonishing thing was that by treating such a small percentage of the cells and returning them, the other cells disappeared. So it was clear all the way back in the first patient that somehow, mysteriously, this was fortuitously causing an immune reaction that was treating the rest of the disease. And one could argue that we're not that good because it took from 1982 all the way until 2010, or 28 years, to gain a handle. And many of the clues, I must say, came from my two interviewers, Lynn Wilson and Francine Foss. But we've got a pretty good handle on this now.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit, Rick, in terms of some of the, for our listeners, some of the mechanisms or the understanding of how this really works in terms that the listeners could understand?
So the drug that was used and is used, which has a name that's abbreviated 8-MOP, because we don't even have to bother your listeners with the real long name, that drug is actually a naturally occurring substance found in small quantities in figs and lime and in larger quantities in the root of a weed that grows in most of our backyards called Queen Anne's lace. It does nothing by itself. But if you take it, as dermatologists have known for a long time by mouth, although it's excreted without any activity, any effect in 24 hours, if you shine light on any tissue that temporarily has it in it, which is usually 2 hours after a person has ingested the drug, this inactive drug gets instantaneously converted to a very potent chemotherapeutic agent which binds and inactivates DNA. So the mechanism as we fast forward does relate to the original suggestion that it's such a finely tunable drug because it only is active where the light and the drug come together for literally millions of a second. But what actually happens is something very surprising. Which is why it wasn't discovered on purpose. As the blood is passed from one arm vein through a machine where the light is shined on the blood, as we had always planned, before it's returned to another arm vein, a very abundant protein in the blood, generally involved in blood clotting, fibrinogen, sticks to the plastic in the ultraviolet exposure system and actually within seconds completely coats that plastic surface. So the cells that are passed through that surface, including the leukemic cells in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, never actually encounter the plastic surface. Those that are closest to the surface encounter the platelets, also typically involved in clotting, which have stuck to the fibrinogen, just as they do in clotting. And now a white blood cell called a monocyte, which was also not the cell we were targeting at first, but a so-called antigen-presenting cell, but not that good an antigen-presenting cell in the form that it circulates in the blood as a monocyte, now sticks and unsticks and literally jumps from platelet to platelet on that plate. And it's that interaction with the platelets, probably just as happens in wound healing and in sites of inflammation, converts these monocytes two dendritic cells within a single day. And those dendritic cells, named because of their shape, normally are only 0.1% of the circulating white blood cells, but 70% of the monocytes that pass through this apparatus within one day become dendritic cells, which are the most potent trigger of immune reactions. So to very briefly summarize that, this treatment has had its impact on the immune system because all these years, secretly, by mechanisms that had not been recognized before, this treatment is converting monocytes into dendritic cells that stimulate immune reactions, probably because that's the way it really happens.
So, Rick, you recently published or are about to publish this in the highest tier journal in the field of hematologic malignancies, the journal Blood. And this paper elucidates this mechanism that you described to us. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of those findings, particularly with respect to the fact that there are other ways to view these antigen-presenting cells and to prepare these antigen-presenting cells, and there are other immunotherapies out there? Can you talk a little bit about the impact of your findings in this paper?
So one of the really puzzling and even disappointing features of immunotherapy for cancer, which has always had so much promise because it's really such a powerful, intricate system, and we know that the immune system, even as we speak, is protecting us against cancers we'll never see. We know that people who get immunosuppressed as part of an organ transplant have a much higher incidence of particularly cancers of the skin that presumably are normally being destroyed before they ever get to that point of being clinically evident. So the question has always been, why can't immunotherapy in the face of clinical cancer do just as well? And it does. It does often induce clinical responses, but they've been generally disappointing. And then why would a treatment that was not even designed as an immunotherapy turn out to have such a good record? Well, part of it is that the immune system is incredibly complicated. And in a way, certainly we also in our own group fall prey to this. We tend to think that we can create immunologic responses because we're smart enough to do that. Well, we're generally not. And we learn from experience like this. So the answer to your question in a very succinct way is that the way that dendritic cells have been manufactured, which has been a great advance pioneered largely from originally Rockefeller University, were breakthroughs. But if you look closely at them, they are not that's not the way the body could possibly ever do it. The amounts of growth factors that are used over a full week to induce the conversion is a thousandfold what is normally present in the body. So the question will be, since we fell into this by actually probably co-opting the way it may normally happen in one day without any added growth factors, maybe now one can take that knowledge and try to use it in other kinds of cancer.
Well, Rick, this is really a fascinating story. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about immunotherapy with Dr. Richard Edelson.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2009, there were over 65,000 new cases of melanoma in this country. Over 1,000 patients are diagnosed annually in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer Grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR Grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Radio Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today, we're joined by Dr. Richard Edelson, and we're discussing photopheresis and immunotherapy. So, Rick, I have a two-part question for you. This is a fascinating story that you were obviously spearheading during the majority of your career, and we do a lot of photopheresis at Yale. Is this done in other centers, and how commonly is this done around the world? And the second part of the question is, could you discuss what other malignancies or other clinical problems that you think this treatment could be applicable to?
So, Lynn, photopheresis, which started really here, it was used for the first time in the Yale Cancer Center. So it's a Yale homegrown therapy on the basis of clinical responses and an excellent safety profile. In fact, I'm not aware of a single patient who had to stop the treatment after responding because of side effects. The issue originally was, how do you explain how this treatment works? But here, if we fast forward again to 2010, the treatment is used throughout Europe and the United States, and has become the most widely used cellular immune therapy, even though the mechanism has only just now become elucidated. So it is widely used, and the question about what other cancers it could be used for begins to become a very interesting question. Because now that we know that this simple treatment, which a patient receives over a two-hour period as an outpatient, lying comfortably on a blood-drawing type of couch, even watching television, is something that might be applicable to other kinds of cancers, solid tumors, that cannot be cured surgically. So the key to the way photopheresis works in T-cell lymphoma is that the drug that we mentioned damages in the bloodstream the malignant cells, and essentially feeds them to the new immunogenic dendritic cells that we talked about. And so the dendritic cells, loaded with digested parts or antigens that are distinctive of the malignant T cells, goes back into the body as essentially a cellular vaccine. Well, if that's the actual way that this is happening, as it appears, that then other kinds of cancers become susceptible, at least in concept, to this. If you can get your hands surgically, for example, on a lung cancer, a breast cancer, name the kind of cancer. If that cancer is capable of stimulating an immune reaction at all, then those cells could be damaged in a different way and then incubated or placed together overnight with the new dendritic cells, which then can perhaps become a vaccine for those cells and that cancer. And in collaboration with Dr. Foss, Tom Rutherford in gynecologic oncology, his close colleague, Dr. Gil Moore, and several people in our group, one of the first cancers that we will try to treat that way, is ovarian cancer, because there is a cancer quite severe, often at early diagnosis, at initial diagnosis, because it's already advanced. And in those cases, we will try to immunize those patients against their cancer. I emphasize that these kinds of studies are very preliminary. In fact, that study has not even yet begun.
So, Rick, we're talking about these antigen-loaded dendritic cells stimulating an immune response against the tumor. Is that what normally happens in a cancer patient? Is that recapitulating, say, a normal process in the patient?
Well, it's very tough to know, and it would be very nice if that's the case. But by the time we actually diagnose a cancer, if the immune system had originally slowed its progression or prevented cases like it, by the time we see that cancer, the immune system's already been overrun. So what really is confronting the clinician who is attempting to then turn the immune system back on is that you're really trying to get the horses back into the barn, and you're running in reverse.
So do you think that these kinds of immunotherapies that we're talking about would be most useful for patients, say, after they've received their chemotherapy and their disease is at a minimal level, or perhaps early on in the course of their disease?
Well, what you want to do, of course, if you're going to marshal the strength of the immune system to fight cancer, is you also have to have an immune system that's fully functional. So chemotherapy, at least certain kinds of chemotherapy that you both know better than I, can suppress the immune system. So you would not want to use a treatment like this in a patient whose immune system could not respond. But a lot of the other more biologic modern therapies that both of you have pioneered don't involve suppression of the immune system. So, for example, a great way to limit the number of malignant cells that would need to be attacked by an immune system that you turn back on would be the kind of radiotherapy that Lynn Wilson does, because it really, by and large, does not suppress the immune reactions. And several of the treatments that you developed also circumvent suppression of the immune system. I would favor those in association with this treatment as opposed to conventional therapies.
Rick, you had mentioned that the treatment, photopheresis, is very safe for patients and that you've not been aware of even one patient who's had to discontinue therapy, assuming they're responding, because of toxicity. Could you just briefly describe for our listeners what's involved? You had mentioned lying down on a comfortable blood-drawing couch, venous access. What are really the side effects of the treatment, if there indeed are any? Because I agree, it's very well tolerated.
The side effects of the treatment involve the same kind of side effects that blood drawing itself for a blood donor might have. If you give, if you donate a unit of blood, most people can tolerate that very well. That's approximately the amount of blood that is outside the body at any given time being processed through the apparatus and then returned to the patient. But some people, with low blood volumes or with cardiac insufficiency, might have some difficulty because of temporary volume depletion. So their blood pressure might drop, and that would be reversed quickly by attentive nurses and the overseeing physicians by then returning that blood. The other kinds of reactions that can occur can be in the circumstance where the treatment actually is working too fast, where the photoactivatable drug is injuring the cells that are particularly susceptible to it a little too fast, so that over the first few hours when the blood goes back, a lot of the cells, a lot of the malignant cells might be dying and releasing their products. These are not very dangerous typically, but one has to be on their toes.
Now, patients get this treatment as an outpatient, is that correct? And they go home.
That's right.
And do they have to have precautions when they leave your center in terms of exposure to light or anything else that could happen to them when they walk outside?
There is one very important thing, and that is that as the blood passes through the machine, it's important that it not clot in the machine. And we certainly have many protections against that eliminate the possibility of accidentally returning a clot, so that doesn't happen. But these patients have to have their blood thinned with a drug called heparin. That drug doesn't wear off for a few hours after they leave, so we highly advise individuals who leave not to have an automobile accident.
So, Rick, can I go back again to talk a little bit about this new technique that you're developing to take photopheresis to the next step, which is to try to introduce tumor cells to these antigen-presenting cells that have gone through the machine? And are there some new ways that you're developing now in collaboration with other areas or expertise at Yale that would help us to better deliver those tumor cells to these antigen-presenting cells?
So these are areas of very active investigation. One area is, for example, as Lynn Wilson and I and colleagues discussed over a number of years, is in areas like the lung, one could irradiate and damage, not necessarily in a curative way, classical non-small cell lung cancer, and then introduce these new dendritic cells intravenously, where they then pass directly, a very simple introduction, the same way we always do, back to the right side of the heart, which pumps blood through the lung and to the lung. So that was a very attractive way of getting these new dendritic cells directly to the site of damaged malignant cells, and hoping that that encounter could accomplish the goal of immunizing the patients. In other kinds of solid tumors, there are a number of different approaches that can be taken building on the scientific advances. So, for example, one of the most interesting and intriguing to us is, in fact, as you know, the approach that we're planning to take in ovarian cancer for the first time, and that is to do a single photopheresis treatment, hold on to the new dendritic cells that come out, and they're actually typically now up to 500 million of them, and freeze them in a way in small test tubes of aliquots of only 10 million each. So 500 million would lead to 50 different aliquots that could be frozen and saved. And instead of giving the cells back to the patient after adding the ovarian cancer antigens, have 50 different vials of such cells and immunize them by injecting it into their skin. So one could boost the immunity in an oncologist's office, for example, and even tell whether the patient has truly been immunized against the cancer by whether they develop a little bump at that site, just like a tuberculin reaction. So these are kinds of exciting new advances, and time will tell.
And so basically, all of these techniques involve a patient's own tumor cells being introduced to the antigen-presenting cells. And that's a little bit different than, say, some of the other vaccine strategies out there where they're using a protein like MUC1, for instance, which is a protein expressed on a number of tumors from many different patients, and trying to immunize a patient against that. In this case, you're immunizing a patient against their own tumor cells.
That's right. This is an ultimate example of personalized therapy, but it's also important to emphasize that we're always dealing as physicians with practical considerations. So there are so-called markers or antigens that can stimulate immune reactions against a tumor type in general, like a melanoma, like ovarian cancer. But the most important antigens may be the ones that are very unique to that person's malignant cells. And you can't have a preparation that's put into a bottle for every single patient that really knows and identifies each patient's individual array of antigens. But the immune system and their own dendritic cells can do that sorting for you if you give them, as a source, the malignant cells. So what you say is exactly correct, Francine, and that is that the attraction of this treatment is that it is so unique and so simple to apply to the individual patient.
Dr. Rick Edelson is Aaron and Marguerite Lerner Professor of Dermatology and Professor and Chair of the Department of Dermatology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.